Finding great candidates to hire can be like, well, trying to find a needle in a haystack. Sure, you can post your job to some job board, but then all you can do is hope the right person comes along. Which is why you should try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful technology identifies people with the right experience and actively invites them to apply to your job. You get qualified candidates fast. So while other companies might deliver a lot of hay, ZipRecruiter finds you what you're looking for. The needle in the haystack.
See why 4 out of 5 employers who post a job on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free, at ZipRecruiter.com/zip. That's ZipRecruiter.com/zip. ZipRecruiter.com/zip.
Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment production. You can find the show on social media at the Turning Tides Podcast on Facebook, Instagram, Threads, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Blue Sky and Mastodon. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast or collaborating, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you. Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of enslavement.
History is not a parabola, not a linear path. History is a maze of false starts, dead ends, parallel paths, all leading in mostly unpredictable ways. Our job is not to project a curve into the past that ends at a known spot in the present, not to calculate the quickest path from some hypothetical point in the past up to the pueblos of the present. Our job is to know, as best we can, what actually happened in the past and ponder how, from that point in the past, the knotted threads of history produced the present. Dr. Stephen H. Lexon, The Study of Southwestern Archaeology, University of Utah Press, 2018, page 66.
Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Joseph Pescone, and I'd like to say thank you for tuning in to this very special episode of the Turning Tides podcast. Today, we have Dr. Stephen H. Lexon joining us. He is a world-renowned archaeologist and a prolific author who focuses on the Southwest and the Puebloan peoples. His works were instrumental in the writing of my series covering the history of the Pueblos, and I'm very excited to have such an influential voice on the show. Steve, how are you doing today?
Quite well. How about yourself?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for being on the show. And thank you so much for adding your expertise to sort of supplement my series. So I think the first question that I have to ask is, what is the explanation for the shift toward the term ancestral Pueblo? I've seen the peoples who inhabit the southwestern United States be referred to as Pueblo, Puebloan, Asquewi, Hisatsinom, Cliff Dwellers, and the controversial term Anasazi. It seems that many are still dead set on using this last and most controversial term to describe the native southwestern peoples. So what are your thoughts on the subject?
Well, the term Anasazi is not a Pueblo, not from a Pueblo language. It's Navajo, because they're Pueblo people, or not a single people. They're like, you know, they speak 4 different languages, and they're a very different social organization. We call them all Pueblos. But they're Pueblo people, and then there are Navajo people that inhabit the same part of the Southwest. And, of course, Apache people and Piman people down in southern Arizona, so there's a lot of different folks. The archaeologists, when they first started out, stumbling around the Four Corners area and finding all these empty cliff dwellings and things like that. And they asked the local people who are Navajos, you know, who are these guys? And Navajo said something, I don't speak Navajo, said something like Metzazi, which means it's a long time ago and it wasn't Navajo. Basically, it's in the long, you know, it's been translated many different ways. The enemy ancestors or, you know, it was basically boils down a long time ago and not Navajo. So some of the archaeologists picked up on that, turned it into, anglicized it into Anasazi. The first real serious archaeologists who came into the Southwest use the conventions that we use back east and every place else, and those are geographic, where they talked about the ruins of the Four Corners as the San Juan culture because the San Juan River flows through it as the main drainage. Mm. And, you know, the Gila River, there's the Rio Grande, those are the names that they gave these places. But Anasazi, a lot of Southwestern archaeology has to do with tourism and marketing in Santa Fe and Sedona and places like that. And Anasazi was much more romantic. However, it is a Navajo term, and the Pueblos aren't happy about that because they think that those are the Pueblos being living villages of Native American people, 20 of them in New Mexico and another 20 over in Arizona. They weren't crazy about having like cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde that they felt were their ancestors being called Anasazi. The term that has replaced it almost completely is ancestral Pueblo, which some of the names that you mentioned there, like Hisatsunom, that's a Hopi name. I mean, you know, there are Pueblo words for these guys. On the other hand, they speak three absolutely different languages. And one of those languages, the Tewa, is, you know, three dialects, Tewa, Tewa, Toa, that are difficult to be mutually understandable. So, you know, whose language are you going to use? Right? If you put the Hopi word on it, Hisatsunom, then the other Pueblos are annoyed. So, somebody came up, and I think I might have been at the initiation with ancestral Pueblo, which is getting some pushback now because it sort of assumes what is to be proven. There are lots of legal issues that are subsumed under that term. That is just by fiat, it makes all those places up there Pueblo. It's ancestral Pueblo. Which Pueblo? Well, they can fuss about that in court or in museum displays or whatever. So, yeah, it went from Anasazi, which was an early loose term derived from Navajo people that got popular. And then the archaeologists came in and tried to turn it back into what it probably should have always been, like rivers and geographic, like the San Juan cultures of the Four Corners around the San Juan river drainage. Anasazi beat that out because it was more appealing to some people. And then ancestral Pueblo, after about 1990, which is where I think that term originates, has pushed Anasazi out, except on the Navajo Reservation, which is a huge piece of turf right in the middle of the Four Corners, but it's a good chunk of the northwest New Mexico, northeastern Arizona. If you do archaeology on the Navajo Reservation, Navajo Nation, you can't use that term ancestral Pueblo. You have to use Anasazi because they feel that they are related. The Navajo people do not deny that those are ancestral Pueblo places, but they feel they were also at the table at that time. They're also part of that history. Anyway,
there is some evidence of some sort of mixing of the two cultures, but from what I understand, it wasn't toward the very end of their sort of respective independence, if I can use that word, where they made like mini Pueblos.
Yeah. Well, the Navajos would say that's not true.
Okay.
What you're saying is true. For a long time, the historians and the archaeologists said, oh, the Navajos show up, you know, long after places like Chaco Canyon and Mesa Verde were left. But the Navajos say, no, we were here before that. And they have very detailed histories, which they are pleased, I don't know if they're pleased, but they're perfectly willing to share about what happened in those places. Like, they were there. Increasingly, I think the archaeologists are listening to the Navajos about that stuff because they're willing to talk about it, where most of the Pueblos aren't, which is, of course, annoying the Pueblos. You know? And all this plays out in on several levels, like in a national park. Who does the interpretation of national park? Legally, there's, you know, museum laws, Native American Grave Protection and Repatriation Act of 1990, where tribes are getting back from museums and government agencies, human remains and objects that probably should have never have been taken out of the ground.
Yeah.
And you have to decide who's related to what. And, you know, the Navajos want to be at the table for that one, too. And the Pueblos don't want them there. On an even larger scale, there are land claims issues, where this actually comes down to people's lives and money and economies and stuff, where in the 1946, right after World War II, in part to acknowledge the role of Native American people in that war, you know, serving as soldiers, we had to pass a law that was a land claims, established a land claims commission where tribes could sue the United States for the value of the lands that they can demonstrate that they lost in bogus treaties and stuff like that. And the land claims cases strung out over, oh man, I think the last one was like in the mid-70s. And they're still, you know, reaching conclusions. A lot of those were based on archaeology. They got some archaeologists and they're saying, oh yeah, there's this ruin that goes with Hopi Pueblo and this ruin that goes with that and that. And these are court cases. You know, with all the, they're treated like, you know, it's evidence in a court case. So these names, actually, they matter historically to these people. They matter in terms of their public perception or public presentation in a park or a museum or something like that. And on one level, which these guys are very, these guys being the Native American tribes, are very aware of, there are legal implications, land implications that are about, you know, money and keeping being able to feed your kids, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah, it's a complicated issue for sure, and it's something I don't even want to comment on. Just not even understanding the internal politics between each tribe and between each nation, it must be a real can of worms. And especially like you were saying, you have this term Pueblo, which is a sort of blanket term for a massive culture. I think you say that it would be like if you took, if you went from Paris, France to Stuttgart, Germany, and just said, oh, these are all the same people. Forget it, whatever, and acted like, yeah, there was no difference. It's a very similar scenario. So speaking of another people of the Southwest, the Hohokam, which lived contemporaneously with the ancestral Puebloans and the Navajo, possibly, they lived around the Phoenix, Arizona area. They always seem to me to be the odd man out when talking about the Southwest and the people that resided there. They had a unique culture, a unique society. They had unique burial practices, which weren't practiced elsewhere in the region. So how did Hohokam differ from their ancestral Puebloan contemporaries? And was there a meeting or a meshing of the two cultures at any point?
Hohokam is another term that the archaeologists took a native term from a Piman language, because the people in southern Arizona, as you mentioned, largely Piman tribes down there, Odam, folks like that. There's a Piman word, Hohokam, and again, I don't speak Piman, so you know if there's any Pimans listening, I apologize for my pronunciation, but the archaeologists interpreted that as all used up ancestors. And so the archaeologists take that term, just like Anasazi, from a local native people and apply it to the whole area. Early on, the archaeologists called that the Rio Gila culture, drink, you know, and because it's mostly along the Gila River and the Salt River in southern Arizona. Okay, it's really different environment than where the Pueblo people live. Pueblo people are up on the Colorado Plateau, which is a huge landmass, but it's elevated enough that it gets just enough rain that you can do rainfall farming. Not all the time, unfortunately, but when you come south from the Pueblo country on the Colorado Plateau, it drops off. There's a thing called the Mogollon Rim, and it's quite dramatic. You can stand up on the Mogollon Rim and you're in pine trees, and you look down and there's saguaro cactuses, the big, you know, armed cactuses. And that's Hohokam country. When you see saguaros, yeah, those are people that are adapted to a very different environment. And you can't do rainfall farming down there. You have to do irrigation. And the Hohokams were master of that. So they had irrigation systems that were huge. so big that in pre-Columbian New World, it's bigger than anything in Mexico. You have to go to Peru to find, you know, canals that stretch for that many miles, that big, that many miles, whatever. And the Pueblo people, ancestral Pueblo people, didn't do that. They did a little canal irrigation, but Hohokam was just a huge infrastructural investment. To make a big canal system work, you have to have somebody making decisions about who gets the water and when's the water running and all that kind of stuff. And it's contentious. There's not real good evidence that there were governmental structures in Hohokam. There certainly is a Chaco up north in the Pueblo world, but they had a system of ball courts, and these oval earthen monuments, you know, that vary in size from kind of tiny to what we would consider a ball field. And the notion is that these ball games, just like in Mesoamerica, and the ball games were a spectacle that everybody came to see, and there was a lot of politics and going on at the same time, and trading and economic stuff, and they were the kind of glue that held everything together. So Hohokam, you got ball courts. Anasazi, or ancestral Pueblo, never had ball courts. They don't do that. That Mogollon Rim that I was talking about is a real divider, and there's not a lot of stuff moving back and forth across it, not a lot of people moving back and forth across it. Towards the end, when Hohokam's falling apart, and it hits its peak about 900 AD and then falls back in on the Phoenix Basin. Up at the northwest end of the Mogollon Rim, where the rim gets lower, and you actually have the plateau and the deserts kind of meeting, there's a national monument, national park maybe, called Wapatki. And it's a great Chaco great house, after Chaco, with a great kiva, which is typical of the north, these big round subterranean buildings where you get a whole bunch of guys, a whole bunch of people in there watching something. And alongside that's a ball court. That's the one place, the most dramatic place anyway, where the Hohokam ball courts meet the ancestral Pueblo world. And it comes after Hohokam's really on the decline, which is interesting. What's that all about? And also after Chaco's on the decline.
Wow.
But otherwise, they don't seem to have much to do with each other. There's trade in exotic items, I think, between the leadership, and obviously there were leaders in Hohokam, because, again, you have to make decisions about irrigation that require a small number of people calling the shots. And the leaders at Chaco, like Hohokam cotton shirts show up at Chaco. They're very distinctive. But that's about it. Not a lot of pottery going back and forth, not a lot of staple stuff going back and forth.
Interesting.
So, in your opinion, which disaster was more destructive to Pueblo lifeways? Was it the great drought and following great abandonment of 1250 to 1300, or was it the La Entrada by the Spanish in 1600?
Given the choice between those two, I would say it was the Spanish colonization, the Entrada. The great drought is often linked to the out-migration from the Four Corners. When tens of thousands of these Pueblo people leave places like Mesa Verde and Chaco Canyon and Canyon de Chelly, all the places where we have parks now, they leave. And at one point we thought it was because of that drought, but they're bailing out long before that drought comes along. And their whole villages that pick up and leave as early as the 1220s when weather's fine up there. It's raining, which is the important thing. It's got to rain so you can grow corn, feed your kids. They're doing fine, but they're not doing fine politically. The political system's falling apart, and there's a lot of violence. And villages are saying, this stinks, we're out of here. And they go down to where the Pueblos are today, and there's already people where the Pueblos are today, at Hopi and Zuni, and there's already people down there, and they probably knew them, related to them. So they're moving out, and the drought comes along, and that's like the exclamation point in the end. Most of the people are gone long before the drought hits. And they had weather droughts about that bad before and not left. I mean, it set them back, but they done okay. The Spanish Entrada, as well as just like the colonization everywhere. I mean, that was really, the hammer comes down. I mean, they're already decreasing probably in population. That's probably true all over North America for reasons we don't understand. And then the Spanish come in, and you go from when the Spanish arrive, you know, there's probably 80 to 100 pueblos or whatever, and you're down to 40 today. You know, a lot of that's, you know, reaction, the bad things that come with colonization, disease, and then the income, relocation of native people onto the estates of Spanish nobles and stuff like that. And, you know, they re-Christianize them, you know, Catholicize them. And the Pueblos are pretty adaptable. They put up with that as long as they can continue their own traditions. But it has had an impact. I mean, you know, it's this beginning of the colonial period. That's huge. The Great Divide I'm talking about, that is a Great Divide. It's a Great Divide. But there's a Great Divide at 1300. Mm-hmm. Pueblo, before 1300, and that's the end of it, there were governments. There was a capital city in Chaco Canyon, and it moved north to a place called Aztec Ruins, which is just the name the local people gave it. It's not really Aztec, but it was the new capital. Pueblo people. We're not talking about, you know, Spanish capital. We're talking about a Pueblo capital. A native indigenous civilization that at Chaco's height, you know, it includes an area the size of Ohio, and, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who are all looking at this city, small city at Chaco, as the center. And they may not have been looking at it fondly, but, you know, there is a political system with one, you know, one city telling other people, something like a government, probably mixing in a lot of church and state together, and an economy and all that kind of stuff. So they're used to that, which is the way everybody else is living in North America at that point, where you have nobles and commoners and that sort of thing. They're used to that, and then it falls apart, and everybody leaves the four corners. They vote with their feet, and the nobles go south. They get out of there. You don't have nobles anymore in the Southwest. If you act like a noble in a pueblo, if you think you're better than everybody else, the old guys will come talk to you and tell you, no, you're not. So they have a leveling thing where they turn their backs on Chaco and all that. This is in 1300. So we're never going to do that again. And again, there's Pueblo people talk about this, where they say, yeah, we have a ceremony of forgetting, you know, that was amazing or appalling while it lasted, but we're not doing that anymore. And they reinvent themselves as a essentially egalitarian, small farming villages. I mean, you still have people calling the shots because you have to make decisions about land and, you know, adjudicate tips and stuff, but you don't have nobles anymore. And they just, you know, they turned their back on that. So that's after 1300. You don't see that anymore. And there's a lot of things that disappear archaeologically too after 1300. So that's a big watershed. And then when the Spanish come in, of course, that's another huge watershed.
Oh yeah, and as you were referring to the polity at Chaco Canyon, you talk a lot about it possibly being of Mesoamerican origin. It seemed, and you talk a lot about this using the term diffusion. So it seems pretty obvious to me that Mesoamerica, which is undoubtedly the most powerful entity in all of North America, spread their beliefs all over and plenty of other places knew that Mesoamerica was there and that they were the big kahunas.
Yeah.
So why is there such pushback against this idea, with some detractors even calling it anti-science?
For one thing, there's more than one Mesoamerica. I mean, there are any number of empires and city-states and stuff down there.
True.
Which were interacting differentially with Chaco or with the Mississippi Valley or whatever. The people up at Chaco and the people in the Mississippi Valley, you know, had to know about Mesoamerica. It's not like they were ignorant. They knew what was down there, and they knew how it worked. I mean, they certainly would know, and we're talking in ancient times. People at Chaco would have known that, yeah, you had kings and emperors and nobles and commoners and that kind of stuff. So when they set up a government, you know, that's the obvious model to follow. At one point, people thought that there are actually people from Mesoamerica coming up to be the nobles at Chaco. Most of the research, I am reasonably certain that people from Chaco went to Mesoamerica, and that you had Mesoamerican people, you know, high class people coming up to Chaco to visit. I think most of it's homegrown. you know, it's homegrown, but it's the recipe they're using is a Mesoamerican recipe where you have, you know, a capital city and nobles and commoners and that kind of stuff. I mean, everybody down there has the capital city and nobles and commoners, and however many different polities they had down there, you know, 20 or 30. And all up and down the Mississippi Valley, same thing. So that's diffusion. Back in the 80s, 70s and 80s, a long, long time ago, when I was young and just learning archaeology went through this delusional spasm of thinking that it was a science. We're going to be a science and, you know, operate like physics. We're not. We're history. And we can be systematic and good scholars and all that kind of stuff, but we're history. We use a lot of science, you know, like we use a lot of science in what we do, but basically our logic is historical. But that didn't suit people in the 70s, and they thought things like diffusion and migration, which are perfectly reasonable historical dynamics, that they didn't explain anything. They're not explanations. So they really pushed back against migration and diffusion. Of course, the fact that Southwest is famous for migrations, you know, that came with the territory, I kind of overlooked that. And the diffusion, part of that, honest to God, is because we have a boundary, an international boundary between the United States and Mexico. I mean, they have their ruins, we have our ruins. Never the twain shall meet. And that, you know, that really starts off in the early days of Southwest archaeology, you know, the 1890s, and it continues on through that. Yeah, they got corn from Mesoamerica and they got this, but then it's like a gated community. You know, they took a few things and then slammed the door shut. No, I mean, they, you know, that's not how life works. I mean, the people up north would be interacting with people down south and vice versa. You know, it would vary in intensity, but all through the whole history of the Southwest, I'm sure you got people coming and going and ideas traveling and all that kind of stuff. That's just how history works everywhere.
Yeah, and it's almost, I don't know if rude is the right word, but it's kind of like demeaning to these people that like, oh, okay, we'll completely accept that the Roman Empire borrowed plenty of their societal and cultural traits from the Greek Republic city-states, for example. But when we try to apply the same thing to, you know, these Mesoamerican polities, you call them altepetals, if I'm using that word correctly. When we try to apply the same thing to the Southwest, there's this immense pushback, like, oh, there's no way this could have happened. There's no way these people could have done achieved such things. They couldn't organize themselves societally in the same way as they were doing elsewhere in the world. And I don't know, it always has seemed to me a little bit, I don't know if insensitive is the right word, but there is some, maybe some grains of the original archaeologists who, you know, were sure that these were just quote unquote savage people or whatever. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I would say the original anthropologists, for some reason, archaeology in the U.S. is in anthropology, and it should be in history. But the founder of American anthropology, one of the most important founding fathers, is Lewis Henry Morgan, who was a lawyer back in New York who got interested in Indians. And he decided that there had never been any what he called civilizations, by which he meant the state with the government and that kind of stuff. In the New World, there never had been, that all the Spanish accounts of the Aztecs, for example, was a Spanish hyperbole, which, of course, Mexican archaeologists just snickered at that. But he's training people in the 1880s to believe this, and they're training people, he's like the font of all this, that nobody ever did anything interesting in North America. By interesting, I mean, you know, had a government or a state or whatever. But very clearly they did. The archaeology is totally unambiguous here with a place like Cahokia in the Mississippi Valley or Chaco in the Southwest. But, you know, what you're hearing is pushback from people who, you know, were taught by people who were taught by people who were taught by people who were taught by people that there were never any states that which were, you know, civilizations north of Mexico. And, you know, that's just what we were taught to believe. And it's really hard to weed that out. At base, it's really colonial. And to some extent racist. Or Lewis Henry Morgan was a mild racist, as most Victorian gentlemen were. But he was basically saying that Native American people didn't have the chops to do interesting things like have a state, you know, or to have a capital city or that kind of thing. And, you know, that they're very interesting. But yes, like you said, they're noble savages.
Yeah.
And this is not true. I mean, they're definitely maybe noble, but, you know, certainly did most of the things that people did everywhere else in the world.
Yes. Yes. Agreed. So we've talked a little bit about diffusion. So what exactly is the difference between diffusion and hyperdiffusion, which is a term that has been bandied about a little bit more recently? And how would you debunk the incorrect belief that either aliens or Atlanteans built the great houses?
Two different questions, but hyperdiffusion, the way I've heard the term used, is when you think there's one source for everything. At one point in Europe, for example, they thought everything starts in Egypt. And what do they call that? I forget the term. You know, this would be in the late 19th century, that everything starts in Egypt and then diffuses outward. So, you know, it's like people outside of Egypt couldn't come up with anything new themselves, which is just nonsense. A lot of stuff did come out of Egypt, but people were doing all kinds of other interesting things. So, yeah, it had a go. Hyperdiffusion had a go in Europe for a while. The way it has been used in North America is that you have Central Mexico, and even that doesn't work. I mean, you have the Aztecs and the Maya, but those are two different civilizations in different parts of Mexico, and stuff. All good things ooze out from there. A lot of good things are diffused, or not good, but a lot of really important, interesting things are diffused out of Central Mexico. But then the people in, you know, Mississippi Valley and the people in the Southwest are cooking stuff up themselves. You know, they're not waiting for the next bulletin from the center. They're making up stuff on their own. Hyperdiffusion's got to be different than ancient aliens or, that's just willful self-delusion. there's nothing in the Southwest that people couldn't build. I mean, the like a Chaco. In the great houses, they aren't technological marvels like, I don't know, Stonehenge or something, where, you know, how they did it. You know how they did it. I mean, we're doing it right now. We have a stabilization, not we, the National Park Service has a stabilization crew, mostly Navajo guys out of Chaco, who keep gluing those places back together to keep them from falling down. And, you know, they could put up a wall, you know, Chaco wall. They're nice looking, but they're exercises in labor and patience and skill. But they're not engineering marvels, or they're not otherworldly engineering marvels. I mean, people just stacking up rocks, basically. You know, why they would stack up rocks, over a couple of acres going up five stories, that's a good question. But doing it, you could see how they taught themselves how to do it. I mean, they even at Benito, they tried to build a building with the wrong kind of masonry and it collapses, and they learn from that. And they go, oh, okay, we need to, you know, put some chinking in between the stones, and then it works. There is an appeal, apparently, to a large segment of our population to say that these guys couldn't do it on their own. You know, you got to call in the aliens, or you got to call in people from Atlantis, or whatever. And it's what you were talking about before. It is sort of rudely limiting to the intelligence of the Native Americans, who are quite capable of doing all this. Not quite capable, they did it. Okay.
Yeah.
They probably still would have if we hadn't shown up.
Yeah, and the big argument is like, how could they have built these things? How could they have done this in the desert? How would you do it? I mean, ask yourself the question. You'd probably need a few dozen people. You'd probably need a rigid societal structure, which you claim, and the evidence seems to point to, the people around Chaco Canyon and the Four Corners having. That's how you do it. I mean,
yeah. To get it done, you need a lot of labor, and you need a lot of organized labor that you can control. You know, I don't mean like slave labor, but that you can control, and all the logistics that go with that. You got to feed them. You know, you got to take care of their people back home, that sort of thing. I think probably something at Chaco is where over this big region, something like a labor tax, that's what was going on in Mesoamerica, where you owe the leaders 2 weeks of your time every year, or a month of your time, or whatever, which isn't, it's annoying probably, but it doesn't crush you economically back home. Talking about the commoners that have to provide the labor, because it's a lot of labor. And, you know, that technically Chaco's not a marvel. Aesthetically, it's great. Technically, it's not a marvel, but it is a lot of labor, a lot of work that went into it, work by skillful people. So, yeah, it requires, as you said, a developed political system, a rigid political system, where it can do that logistical work of, okay, we got to get 300 guys in here, we got to feed them, got to get them water, got to get all that stuff, and take care of their people back at home. And, you know, there was a lot of moving parts that would have to be controlled by some small group in the capital city.
And we know that, like, things like the great houses, they took decades to build. So the idea that aliens or this advanced civilization took decades to construct, you know, not rudimentary structures, but pretty basic when you come down to, you know, the history of building things, one stone on top of another, like you were saying, it's kind of ridiculous. Yeah. Like these are really, this is some advanced civilization. They can't even build a two-story great house in a few years. I mean, it's taken them 30, 40 years to complete these things.
Yeah. Well, they, right towards the end, when they moved the capital from Chaco to Aztec, there's a great house there. It's as big as anything in the canyon, and it goes up in a decade. So, you know, that's Chaco at the height of its abilities to organize labor, get the job done. But yeah, like Pueblo Bonito, it took a couple of centuries to, you know, to finish. Some of this, I think, probably bleeds over into astronomy. There's, you know, depending on who you believe, a fair amount of astronomical stuff built into those buildings, probably less than we'd like, you know, some people would like to think. And somehow that becomes a marvel. Oh my goodness, you know, they knew where the moon was. Of course they knew where the moon was. I mean, they've been living there for thousands of years. And, you know, it's not like they have a whole lot of, just spend a whole lot of time watching TV at night. I mean, they got the night sky. And it's, the night sky is quite marvelous and mysterious. And, you know, even knowing what we know about the universe and the night sky, it's quite marvelous and mysterious. If you didn't know that stuff, then boy, those are gods up there, whatever. They're going to pay a lot of attention to that. So the fact that, for example, that they would know when a solstice was, you know, this has been, how they had a solstice marker at Chaco. Oh my goodness. These guys are farmers in a temperate, you know, sort of subtropical arid region. They're farmers. If they didn't know the calendar, which the solstice is a calendar thing, they're going to die, you know, and they and all their ancestors would have known about solstices and, you know, the time of the year, it's time to plant now. It's not, you know, your whole life as a farmer revolves around the annual calendar. So it's interesting that they have a solstice marker. It's not marvelous. I mean, if they didn't, that would be remarkable if they didn't know that kind of astronomy. And so anyway, you know, when you see some of the lower end TV shows and stuff, or History Channel turned into what it did.
Rest in peace.
People are marveling at the astronomy of these primitive people. First off, they weren't primitive. And second off, you know, everybody has that kind of astronomy. You start looking around the world because these people spend a lot of time looking at the sky.
Yeah. The only people who don't have this kind of astronomy are people who are alive today who need to look at their phone to find out when the next full moon's going to be.
Yeah.
So I think that a lot of what you just said is going to bleed into this question a little bit. But the main focus of your book, A Study of Southwestern Archaeology, is Chaco and its raison d'être. Amongst other points, you claim Chaco was likely cosmopolitan, with a variety of peoples living and working for the betterment of the upper classes who inhabited the great houses. What exactly made Chaco, a relatively barren canyon, the capital of this Indiana, or like you just said, an Ohio-sized city-state? Was it merely its central location as compared to Mesa Verde, Kayenta, Rio Grande, etc.? Or do you believe there was another reason behind its construction?
So, why is Chaco where it is? It's actually, when you look at Chaco's region on a map, Chaco's offset to the east. It's not in the middle of this thing. I'm going to give an unsatisfactory answer here, that they built Chaco in the 10th and 11th and 12th centuries. At Chaco, they built the capital because of what happened there in the 6th century. In the 6th century, the technical term for that is, and don't need to go into it, was basket maker three, which, you can bleep that out, because what does that mean?
That just sounds serious.
In the 500s and 600s, centuries before Chaco, there is a huge aggregation of these pit houses in pit house villages at Chaco. Their archaeology at Chaco, a normal site at 500 AD is one pit house or two pit houses, maybe with a picket fence around, not picket fence, I'm being facetious, but with a palisade around. If you find a pit house village from 500 AD or 600 AD that has 20 pit houses, you write a book and you retire. That's a big deal. Well, Chaco, there are two big pit house sites from that time period, at either end of the canyon, each of which had 100 pit houses. And under every one of those great houses and on every knob for the 6 miles or 8 miles between them, there's pottery from that era. So there's pit houses all through Chaco. There's nothing like that anywhere else in the Four Corners. There's no, the pit house sites from 500 AD to 600 AD. Like I said, they're like one pit house or two pit houses. And every once in a while, they get bigger than that, but not much. So something happened to Chaco in the 6th century that created an archaeology of all these pit houses. It doesn't mean they're all occupied at once, but there's something that happens there, which gives us an archaeology of the biggest site by orders of magnitude in the northern southwest in the 6th and 7th century. And then they go away. Okay. In the 800s and 900s, there's a few people at Chaco. But there's another huge site due north of it, we're in the modern town of Durango. Enormous, so much bigger than all the other sites of the 8th and 9th century, that it's the same principles, and it's moving north-south. And they come back to Chaco Canyon when it's time to build the capital. There's something about that north-south line that was really important to them. I have no idea. You talk to Pueblo people, and they're really interested in directions. Some of them say that north is bad and south is good and whatever, but north and south, unlike the solstice, that's calendrical. It's economic. That tells you when it's time to plant, or you can plan around that, the time to plant. North-south doesn't do anything for anybody. It's just a direction, and it's about the only direction these guys would have. If you look at the night sky, they don't have an atlas. They don't have Google Maps. If you look at the night sky, the whole, the sun goes back and forth on the horizon and overhead, of course, every day. And the moon does all kinds of weird stuff. The planets are crazy. They do loop-de-loops. It took, forever to figure out what the planets are doing. But the whole rest of the sky, all stars, revolve around north. They spin, of course, slowly, but, these guys are looking at the sky. And this, you can see the sky spin around north, so it's the only fixed direction that they really have. So I think that's probably why north-south is important, but what it meant to them, I haven't got a clue. So why Chaco is a Chaco, and it's just kicking the can down the road, is because of what, I think, because of what happened there in the 500s and 600s. Something remarkable happened there. I have not a clue what that was. I know what it looks like archaeologically, but I don't have not a, a clue what made all those people show up at Chaco in the 500s and 600s.
Interesting.
So slavery has only been hinted at and being practiced in Chaco and the earlier Pueblo periods. You mention in your book how the early age of many female skeletons points toward enslavement in some form or fashion. What is your take on a controversial subject?
Yeah, slavery, I don't think at Chaco, we're not talking about the kinds of slavery that built the pyramids of Egypt. I think people are volunteering, they're offering their labor, maybe as a labor tax, maybe it's because it's a good thing to go build a great house, who knows. But there probably was slavery at Chaco on the domestic level, because that's almost everywhere you have domestic slavery, where guys will go out on a raid, and then just actually my wife's work, she looked at societies all around the world, that the pre-industrial societies, guys will go out in a raid and they'll bring back slaves. They don't bring back other guys because you can't do anything with them. They're trouble. Bring back kids and women, and you can train the kids to be your people, and that increases your population. And the women come in and are domestic slaves, start off as domestic slaves, and eventually they, you know, maybe wind up getting marrying into the family or whatever. That kind of stuff is going on in the Southwest in historic times, long after slavery was abolished by our Constitution. You still had people going out and raiding Comanches, or Comanches coming in and raiding, you know, Pueblo people or Spanish people, and taking off with women. And those, most of the old Hispanic families in northern New Mexico, if you go back far enough, they've got a tia or a tio, aunt or an uncle or great grandmother or whatever, who was not Spanish, but Comanche or Navajo. So that kind of stuff, I think, was going on in the ancient times too. That you had domestic, you had women and probably kids and some men. They were put to doing drudge chores like grinding corn and, you know, that sort of thing. There's certainly some archaeological evidence for that. It has to do with the human remains of some people, especially young women, who were treated differently than the real family, the women that were really part of the family, who were buried with, you know, dignity and respect. And there's these young women who were bonked on the head multiple times, and then they just throw them out with the trash. I don't think they're part of the family. I think they're domestic slaves. I think most Native, you know, this is something that doesn't come up often, talking to Indians, talking to Native Americans. I think most people would say, yeah, it probably happened, but again, it was happening, you know, it's happening everywhere. It wasn't slavery like our, you know, our industrial slavery in the South, where a whole economy operated off slaves, or Rome, where, you know, 60% of the population were slaves. It'd be small scale, but it'd still be significant, and it would bring in, you know, new blood, new ideas with the people that are coming into the big city. Couldn't have been pleasant, but, you know, ultimately, I think a lot of these people did wind up being marrying in or, you know, becoming accepted in the society that enslaved them.
Enslavement was practiced by basically every single culture or society that was on, and especially the enslavement we're talking about. It was practiced in every single society that was on an intermediate level. Obviously, you're talking, if we're talking about chattel enslavement, like was practiced in America or in, you know, other countries like Great Britain or France, is much more damaging, I think, societally than the slavery we're talking about. Undoubtedly, it probably felt very similar, depending on the person who was enslaved and the level of vitriol of your master or whatever. But it's important to contextualize. This was done everywhere. This was not a Chaco-specific or even a Western hemispheric phenomena. This was done literally everywhere. Take your pick.
Right. You know, you can't say 100% of societies had slaves, but my wife has done a lot of research on this, Kathy Cameron, and yeah, most of them do. And, but again, this small-scale domestic slavery, which you're right, the fact that small-scale doesn't make it any more pleasant for the slaves, but it's very different than chattel slavery, very different than industrialized slavery.
So I'm going to ask you a question about modern politics. So if anyone's listening who doesn't want to hear their favorite billionaire get tarnished, stop listening now. So what points would you make to advocate for the National Park Service and other programs which go towards preserving America's natural wildlife and historical traditions to be given more funding through the federal government? And why should this matter to everyday Americans who are not from the Southwest, but still reside in the United States?
The national park system is, this is not my term, I'm stealing it from someone, I'm trying to think of who I'm stealing it from. It's America's crown jewels. I mean, they're the wonderful places, they're the world famous places. Like Chaco Canyon is a a World Heritage Site. I mean, it's a National Park Service Unit park, but it's also a World Heritage Site that's a list that's kept by UNESCO. People from all over the world know about this place. And increasingly, I think, you know, with the massive increase of tourism that's going on now, more and more heavily visited. The maintenance at a park at Chaco, if they don't have somebody out there taking care of those buildings, they're going to fall down. And for Pueblo people, that might not be a bad thing. They're supposed to fall down. But for us who want to go see them, they require constant care and maintenance because they're just stone and mud. You know, that's not concrete. It's, you know, they need they call it stabilization. They don't rebuild them, but they just patch them back together again after every rainstorm. If you cut that back, you're going to just have a pile of rock, you know, several piles of rocks out there, and not the magnificent buildings that are really known around the world at this point for Chaco. I used to work for Park Service. I have not worked for Park Service in a long time, but I still kind of keep tabs on it. They're already stretched thin. They're stretched real thin. You know, you want to cut park funding, maybe build, you know, one less aircraft carrier and you can take care of the parks. And the parks are not, they're an easy target. They're an easy target because somebody can say, well, I don't live out there. You know, and it's just a bunch of Indian rocks, whatever. But they're not a big part of the federal budget. You know, if you want to actually trim the budget, there are other places to look that spend a hell of a lot more money. Like I say, the Park Service is already stretched thin. You know, you cut it back anymore and you're going to have decreased services, far less safe, and resources that, you know, disappear. Like the Great Houses of Chaco, if you don't take care of them, they'll fall apart.
Yeah, that's a great answer. And like you were saying, if they really wanted to trim the budget, they could probably start with one less aircraft carrier, or maybe they could, you know, look at the Pentagon, who has failed 19 separate audits, and maybe start there and then work their way down to, you know, America's historical monuments, which have existed for thousands of years.
Well, I'm very pro-military. My dad was a career officer. So I'm not slamming the military. It's just that if you are seriously trying to trim the budget down, I think that I agree with you. That's not a bad place to be looking. Not the only place. Not the only place, but not a bad place to be looking.
Yeah.
So some of
but it's a hard target.
Yes. Yeah. No one wants that. No one wants that cut. Yeah.
Yeah, and the parks are an easy target.
So. Mm-hmm.
So some of the original archaeologists who excavated the Southwest, they were destructive, culturally insensitive, outright thieves, or some mixture of all of these. Today, we'd likely prosecute them as pot hunters, but undoubtedly, they contributed to the modern fields of archaeology, anthropology, and ethnography. In what ways did they assist the advancement of our understanding of these cultures, and how did they diminish it?
The early archaeologists, we're talking 19th century guys, late 19th century, people like Richard Wetherill, who was a cattle rancher up in Mancos, who became an archaeologist. He taught himself how to be an archaeologist because he got interested in the cliff dwellings at Mesa Verde, which is just south of the town of Mancos. And he's often given credit for discovering the cliff dwellings. What he did, and he initially goes in and he loots them 7 ways to Sunday and takes the pots and stuff because those cliff dwellings were full of, it's like people just left everything, you know, pots and baskets, whatever. Take it out and try and sell it because, again, he's a cattle rancher, and a cattle ranching is a good way to go bankrupt. You know, it's an income source. Plus, he's fascinated by it. What he does, that's the downside, is he loots the place 7 ways from Sunday. On the upside, and some of this is marketing, right? But he publicizes it. He goes to a world's fair with a whole bunch of pots and stuff and pictures of cliff dwellings and whatever. people didn't know this stuff existed. The local people, the Navajos and the Ute Indians and the local cattle ranchers, they knew it was out there, but nobody back east knew, you know, that this existed. So he publicizes it, he brings it to the national attention, international attention. And Cliff Dwellings and Mesa Verde, I mean, those could be got famous in a hurry. So, yeah, it's a double-edged sword there. I mean, he did some damage with the archaeology. Eventually, he became pretty good, you know, pretty decent archaeologist. But the main thing that he did was get people's attention, including other archaeologists who probably knew a little better about how to do the business. And you know, brought attention to these places that were, like today, are, you know, national parks and World Heritage Sites and things like that. And that came from the early archaeologists, these people that you're talking about who were just stumbling along, trying to figure out how to do it. In a way, I think they probably did more good than harm. They did a lot of harm, but did more good than harm in that it got things started about four decades before they probably would have otherwise, which in a very young field, that 4 decades makes a difference. I don't know if that, does that address your question?
Oh yeah, that definitely answered it. I agree with you. They probably helped more than they hindered the advancement of understanding. There are obviously a few outliers, like what was his name, Frank Cushing, who may or may not have perpetrated a murder to understand more about the Zuni tribe.
Cushing was an interesting fellow, yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, there were people like Wetherill who seems to have been truly interested in advancing, you know, the understanding of humanity. He obviously was making a pretty penny off it off the side, I assume. But at the same time, he was genuinely interested. At least that's what it seems like reading some accounts from, you know, David Roberts talks about Wetherill, the late, great David Roberts. And he talks about Wetherill a lot and all of his opinions on that. And it's hard to argue that what they were doing was, quote unquote, good from a native cultural perspective, but in regards to, I don't know, the rest of us who are just truly interested in understanding the past, it went a long way toward helping that process, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
So before we finish up today, are there any topics, and I know there are a ton that I didn't get a chance to talk about, but other topics that you're passionate about that you'd like to touch on now?
Again, we're moving into the political. Chaco is rather remarkable in the Four Corners area that constitutes the bulk of Chaco's region, which again, you know, was very large, is largely undeveloped. And it's the deserts, it's Navajo country. They herd sheep and farm, and the farming is minimal impact. You have at Chaco a sort of fossilized civilization where the skeletal structure or the circulatory system or whatever is represented by what we call roads, because they look like roads. They're these straight, usually bermed. By that I mean that they're slightly depressed, and there's a berm on either side running alongside the road. And they go for miles and miles and miles, both in between Chaco and its communities, outlying communities in this huge area. And then from Chaco to important natural features, you know, the buttes and stuff like that, that has more to do with cosmology, I guess, probably, but than economics. But these things are hard to see. They're really hard to see. On the ground, they're almost impossible. The early road work, you know, once these were discovered, and the Navajos knew about them, and the Navajos, you know, told the archaeologists, oh, yeah, there's this road that goes from here to here. They live on that land. Get up in the air a little ways, and with raking sunlight, like early in the day and late in the day, you can see them. Some of them. We are finding out, okay, so there's a fair amount of work done on roads, and we realize it's a big, vast system. With LIDAR, which I forget what it's an acronym, I forget what it stands for, but it has to do with radar. It's a way of mapping from the air again. topographic maps that you can then manipulate and enhance the vertical and whatever. These roads are popping out all over the place. And they're all over the place. And you wouldn't see the ones you can see on LIDAR, you can't see on the ground. I mean, when you go down and investigate, you find that, yeah, they're there, but you couldn't see it just walking along. That's remarkable. I mean, we got this whole civilization mapped out for us with these very fragile roads that we don't know how to take care of. I mean, they're long linear features that, you know, how do you deal with that? You can't call it a site, a single site. The issue right now is that they're very susceptible to energy development. The northern San Juan Basin, the northern part of Chaco's region, there's a lot of gas and oil, and it's been hammered already, but with previous administrations and the current administration, they want to drill the crap out of it. And Deb Haaland, who is Secretary Interior under Biden, President Biden, she herself is a Pueblo person. Laguna, I think. Laguna Pueblo. She tried to put a 10-mile radius exclusion zone around Chaco Canyon, which was politically controversial, still is. That's just a 10-mile radius. I mean, what we're talking about is like a 100-mile radius where you find these roads. If you see a developed oil or gas field, they're not high density like Southern California fields are, but they're just a network. It looks like a three-year-old tried to draw a checkerboard. I mean, there's just lines going everywhere. Of roads and modern roads, you know, to service the pumps and stuff and pipelines and all that stuff. There's no way. I mean, I've gone over places where there's almost certainly to be a Chaco road that had been developed for energy with wall pads, roads, pipelines, all that stuff. No way you're ever going to see it. And it's gone. It's gone. With the expanded emphasis or the new emphasis on energy expansion, they want to drill all over as much as they can, it's going to wipe out the road. What we could have learned about the roads. I mean, nobody's willing to pay for LIDAR and the ground truthing and all that kind of stuff for this vast area. Again, we say, you know, about the size of Ohio. But basically, that's what you need to do to protect them. And that's a real problem. I don't know how you deal with that. I mean, not allowing people to drill is taking away people's jobs. I don't know. We don't need the oil and the gas. I mean, that's just nonsense. But you know, there's whole industries built up around it. The Navajo people in the exclusion zone in the 10-mile radius that's been excluded from drilling, there are Navajo people living there on allotment lands. They stood to get a fair amount of money for letting people drill on their land. And now we're saying, no, you can't have that. So there's, you know, the Navajos are really annoyed by all this. The Pueblos are really annoyed by all this. The people that care about the park are really annoyed by all this. But I think it's, you know, the way things are currently going, it's going to happen. And that's too bad because we have a really remarkable archaeological record at Chaco with these roads specifically that I am not optimistic about saving.
That's a really unfortunate thing. I didn't know about the, you said the past minister of the interior attempting to put a 10-mile cordon, I guess, yeah, around Chaco, which, yeah, would have been truly fantastic. And that's nothing.
Well, I think she did it. I think she did it, but it's going to get, I'm sure it's, you know, we're all just waiting for it to get repealed.
Yeah.
There's right. Deb Haaland, H-A-A-L-A-N-D, I believe. But.
Well, and it's such it's a real catch 22 situation because, you know, this is an impoverished community, one of the more impoverished communities in the country. And you can argue that's because of government policy or whatever. But if this stands to enrich them, then who are we, you know, as who are we to say that they shouldn't enrich their own community? And this is
the
probably,
Navajo Nation.
Yeah,
the Navajo Nation is really powerful economically and politically, but individual Navajos, you know, like anywhere else, they there are some that have their haves and have nots and whatever. But the people living around Chaco are just trying to make a living. I mean, they're driving to Chaco to work, or they're driving to Farmington to work, and they're raising sheep, and, you know, they got farms, not there because you can't grow corn there, but up in the hills. So, you know, they'd use the money. They wouldn't mind having the money.
It's definitely a complicated subject. And beyond just oil and gas, you have things like lithium and uranium, which is being found all over the Southwest, which is doing its own separate job of destroying the natural environment and the landscape. I know that in other parts of the Navajo Reservation, a lot of the code talkers from World War II actually got like cancer from all this uranium mining, and they haven't seen a single penny from the in settlement from you know, first their sacrifice in the war, and then to come home and get cancer from a uranium mine.
Yeah, the northern half of Chaco is oil and gas. The southern half is uranium. I mean, there's still big uranium mines all along the southern part of Chaco's region, and mainly Navajo workers.
But it's I think that you made a great case for defending not only the National Park Service, but also laying the groundwork for at least some sort of compromise. I think 10 miles is way less adequate than what the road system must have been like, but it's probably the best like single allotment that you're going to get to preserve, at least in some measure, these ancient roads, which were like as large as a two-lane highway in America today. Or I think you described them as sort of like processional highways, more like a mall thoroughfare than a road.
Yeah, we call them roads because they look like roads, and they did function as transportation. But, you know, these guys had no wheeled vehicles and no beasts of burden. So it's people, you know, walking on them. Mm-hmm. And probably for particular occasions, or again, you know, logistics of getting labor into the canyon, all that kind of stuff. But they do look like roads. Part of the 10-mile exclusion, and this is more from the aesthetics of the park for us, for the visitors, is that one of these, you know, heavily engaged oil or gas fields is an industrial landscape. When you got all these machines going, and you know they burn off the methane, so big flares at night and all that kind of stuff. If they were drilling near, you know, within that 10 miles to Chaco, it would really change how the visitors, I'm not talking about the local people, but you know, visitors who are going to Chaco, how they experience the place. You'd be driving through an industrial landscape with lots of noise and big trucks and all that kind of stuff, and then finally getting to the park. Nobody's planning on drilling on the park, I hope. These days, who knows? But you know, for at least 10 miles around, it would be nice not to have, for us or the visitors, not to have to deal with that.
I don't know why, but I had the visceral image of Elon Musk putting the first nail in the ground, a la Daniel Plainview and There Will Be Blood, in the middle of Pueblo Bonito, and the thing just shooting oil all over the place.
Hope not.
Okay, so as we finish up today, and this is a really great talk, I want to say thank you so much for being on. Anyone who's not who doesn't know about Stephen Lexin or his work, go on Amazon, read all of his books, go on YouTube, listen to all of his talks. He's a wealth of knowledge on the subject. And before we finish up, how can people find you? How can people follow your work? Are you planning on writing another book, or was it true that a study of Southwestern archaeology is the finite?
Yeah, I meant that to be that actually is supposed to be three different books, but I got tired of it at the end and jammed them all into one. I don't plan on writing any more books. You know, these days I do a little bit of work on exhibits or something like that. I'm pretty much retired. I mean, the sources you mentioned, Amazon, or I have a page on what's called academia.edu, which is for, as you might guess, it's for professors and stuff, put papers up, things like that. Anybody can access, you know, if you do academia.edu, Steve Lexin, you'll get my page, which is, it's a bunch of old papers is what it is. You can read them online. You can't download them, but that's about the only active thing I've got going now. I'm not sure if that's even worth mentioning.
Oh no, that's an incredible resource. Anyone who's interested in seriously following like specific topics from an academic point of view should seriously think about getting academia.edu. I think I have like the free version, so I'm able to look at like the PDFs.
It's free. I'm pretty sure access is free for everybody.
Yeah.
Unless you want to download stuff. You have to read it online, which is a pain in the butt. But,
Okay. Well, that was amazing. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Stephen. Thank you so much, everyone, for tuning in. I hope this is acted as a sort of supplemental to my Pueblo series. And I hope you all enjoyed this talk. And Stephen, thank you so much. I hope you enjoyed talking to me. I had a really great time. Thank you.
No, thank you. And good luck with everything.
Thank you so much.
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. We would also appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen, and share the show with your family and friends. It really helps us bring the show to more listeners. Thank you so much for the support, and thanks again for listening.